afternoon. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today on the program, I'm so happy to be speaking with Donald Hall.
Well, thank you.
Donald, welcome. Welcome to...
It's good to be back here in Ann Arbor.
When was the last time you were here, Donald? When was the last trip?
I think it was fairly recently, 2004, maybe for the Ann Arbor Book Forum. Before that, in 2001, I did the Outboard Lecture.
Oh, okay.
So since I moved out...
In 1975.
I don't know how many times I've been back here. Jane, my late wife, Jane Kenyon, grew up here, and we used to come and see her father and mother, her father when he was ill. And her brother is still here, and I saw him this morning. So we came back for family reasons and also for literary reasons.
So you've always kept a connection with Ann Arbor.
Yeah, and we're friends here. I do.
Friends. Yes. And this is where you both met, and you were married in 1972,
that's
that
right.
You said.
Judge's chambers in Ann Arbor.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great. And we were just, right before we started taping, we were talking about your very well-known textbook, Writing Well, which is, like many things about you, Donald, it stood the test of time. It's a lasting piece, Writing Well.
It helped, especially at the beginning, of growing freelance.
Did
that's
it?
When it began to came out and when it began to sell, and it helped. I was giving up tenure here, cradle to the grave, going freelance entirely, and this was a nice beginning for it.
Yes. Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You know what? Maybe what we'll do is I'll read a short biography,
sure.
And then we'll fill in some pieces and come back, because that was a big thing you did when you decided to leave Ann Arbor and tenure, as you said.
It was terrifying.
For a life of a poet. So yeah. Terrifying. And maybe that's what you needed, or maybe that's what
absolutely.
Every...
Absolutely. The best thing I ever did.
So without further ado, as way... For a poet that needs no introduction, really, Donald Hall has published numerous books of poetry, most recently White Apples and The Taste of Stone, Selected Poems 1946 to 2006, The Painted Bed and Without Poems, which was published on the third anniversary of his wife and fellow poet Jane Kenyon's death from leukemia. He has also received numerous awards, including the National Books Critics Circle Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and two Guggenheims. And Donald, you were also appointed the Poet Laureate, consulted in poetry to the Library of Congress, which we usually call the Poet Laureate of the
right.
United States.
A bill was passed to change the name and make it the Poet Laureate.
Oh, just to make it, because that's what we all called it anyway,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that was 2006, was it?
2006-7. Often people take it for 2 years. I could have stayed a second year. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really feel I did very well at it. And so I gave it up after 1 year. Actually, my successor, Charlie Simic, from New Hampshire, also did just 1 year. I think Kay Ryan, President Laureate, is doing 2 years.
Oh, okay. What was it like? What did you have to do? Is it sort of like being being crowned Miss America and suddenly
no.
You're the spokesmodel of all poets? Or
the first reading was sort of celebratory. The first reading is Poet Laureate. That was fun. And there were lots of people there I knew. My children flew up for it, unbeknownst to me. I didn't expect to see them there.
Oh.
That was lovely. But then the duties afterwards weren't very exciting. I had a couple of prizes and so on. Do another reading. The English Poet Laureate, Andrew Motion, came over through the Poetry Foundation, not the library, and he and I read together. And there was some fun. But actually, I had hoped to do more as Poet Laureate.
What do you mean by that, Donald?
Well, Robert Pinsky... started the Favorite Poem Project. Robert Haas started the Poet's Voice, at weekly column. Ted Kooser did more than I did. It was not a good year for me physically, actually. And I did not do nearly so much as I want. At one point, I thought we had a radio series going, but we didn't. That's a long story.
Oh, well, we could start that up, Donald, if you want. We can do that. but and then the year just turned. It turned out to be sufficient.
I felt disappointed in myself and not doing enough, and I did enough for it, really.
Is that normal though? Are you always a little too hard on yourself with this or?
Funny question to answer about oneself.
and about on a writing program, right?
Well, I'm always talking about high ambition and so on. But if you look at me and said and asked, if I knew I was any good, really, or going to last, I would not be able to tell you yes. I have known poets who have said to me, I know I am great, my poems are going to last for hundreds of years.
When did they say it, Donald? Like, when would they...
When they were... At any point in conversation. And I would want to say, take it easy, you're okay, you'll feel better tomorrow.
Because they're feverish.
Well, because they're saying that, because they think they're terrible. I do not know the quality of my own work. Obviously, every time I write a poem, I'm trying to do something perfect. And maybe at one point I think I've done it. But then I dread it when a new book comes through the mail, because when I open it, I'm going to find something I wish I could change.
I think I was reading somewhere that you actually said there was a poem in particular, you were somewhere giving a reading, and on your way to the reading, or the way back from the reading, you actually, it was maybe 30 years between writing the poem, and you thought, that's what I need to do with that one.
I've done that a number of times. When I'm going through a book before a reading, thinking of what I will read, maybe a few hours before the reading, I made revisions in a printed book. I just did that this year with a couple of poems, and then read them that night with the change.
Yes. And what is it that you suddenly know? Is there a way to describe that experience when you're looking at the thing you've made and you know something more about it or something different?
Suddenly I realized that this word isn't quite right, and that word is a single word. And it might be because of the way it fits with other words around it. Or something about the rhythm. I remember with one poem, I made a change that was, I thought, a rhythmical improvement. And no poem was ever finished. I mean, I can always imagine doing something to it before I print it another time.
What does it mean to hope for a poem that can never even be finished to be lasting?
I'll tell you, I don't think there's a single poem in the English language that I adore by Andrew Marvel or Thomas Hardy or Robert Frost or Yeats where I cannot find something I wish were different. There is no hope. I was agreeing about this with a poet friend of mine one time. There is no poem that is as good as poetry ought to be. So
how do we write then, Donald? Like, how
with
do we...
hope, right, with hope and possibly foolishness, but hope and desire and love of the art and wanting to be a part of this art.
Because you knew when you were very young, like you, even before 14, was it, Donald?
Yeah, at 14, I'll say.
Because you had, you were reading Edgar Allan Poe?
That was at 12.
Oh, that was at 12?
Yeah. And I wrote my first poem trying to be as morbid as Poe. But when I was 14, I got pretty serious. And I came home from high school every afternoon and shut the door in my bedroom and worked on poems. And I don't mean I worked on anything that was ever any good, but I was trying. And I really decided this is what I want to do the rest of my life. And I'd gone and done it. But saying all that doesn't mean that what I've done is worth it. I can't claim that. I hope so. But This is not a big deal.
Yes, it's. But it reminds me of a poem that Merwin wrote that I actually just read with my class yesterday. Mm-hmm. That he wrote for Berryman. Like it was, I don't know if you're familiar with it, when he talks about Merriman and what he, it was a way to talk about, I think, even what Merwin feels about the writing life.
Yeah.
And he puts it through the voice of, like, what Berryman taught him.
Oh.
And at the end he says, he asks, like, well, how do I know if anything I ever write is going to be any good? And he says, you can't know. You'll never know. If
Absolutely.
You have to know, you don't write.
Right.
But what you did is, like, you knew what you wanted. Something about, what was it about the poems and the language of poems, Donald, that captured you, that made you know that that was a vocation?
I think the first thing was the sound of poems, the sensual body of poetry. Then the embodiment of feeling by means of this sensual body. And I was continually drawn to the noises that poems make.
And when you say noises, like what is that talking?
I'm trying not to be pretentious, you know.
Yes.
When I say noises.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you're succeeding. And it's also more intriguing to say things like noises, like the noise it makes, because it also it makes it feel like pay attention in a way that if
hear it. When I read a poem silently, I hear every word in my head. I don't read the newspaper that way, or I'd never read the newspaper. I scan, but with poetry, I mean, it's the best prose, really. You need to slow down, read more slowly. And one way with poems is to hear, or perhaps prose, is to hear every line break, every assonance, every bit and piece of the sound of it as you're reading in code. And I actually think that's better, to do it in your head than to read them aloud, because reading aloud, you will make mistakes. There is a pitch you will want to remove. And doing it in your head, like a musician composing without a piano and so on, you more purely apprehend the wholeness of the poem. We were talking about ambition and wanting to be great, knowing you can't be, the other day. Just now I was talking about Henry Moore, the sculptor.
Yes, I love him.
I wrote about.
Yes.
And Henry woke up every morning wanting to be better than Michelangelo and Donatello. And he went to bed every night knowing he wasn't, but determined to get up and do it the next day. And
that's the artist, is it? That's the determination is what...
Yeah, the determination and somehow the gusto for the art that continues to make you want to be superlative, but also the good sense to know that you're not necessarily getting there.
And to keep going.
And to keep going, absolutely. And I think it's the love of the art that will keep you going more than anything else. Not the love of oneself. That's not strong enough.
Not the love of oneself.
No, I don't mean
that.
I'm not proclaiming total modesty here. But I say it's not what drives you.
Right.
It's the love of the art.
Yeah, and recognizing that you found your particular art, because when you found poetry, do you think, is it possible that people don't find, like, people who can have that dedication to the art don't find it as early as you did? Like, what does that mean to find it so early and see the transformations? Because there was something that was even written, Donald, that said, and I think you said that some people, or maybe you felt this way, that when you came into your own as a poet, it was like at the age of 46?
Yeah, I think that there were one or two poems. I put too many in my selected poems, too many earlier ones. I think I found myself largely with a poem called Kicking the Leaves, which was written in Ann Arbor, but sort of looking forward to being in New Hampshire. I knew I was going to be there the next year. And I began to write more poems in that particular vein. Every time my poetry has changed, it has changed, first to my knowledge, by a change of sound. I was writing short lines with lots of enjambment, lots of monosyllabic long syllables, diphthongs, and I changed. Poems were very lyrical, but they sort of excluded the world. And the world began to come back with kicking the leaves. And then there was a lot of the world. And I wrote about it very excitedly. People reviewing my book or my collected poems tend to think that this is when I pass the border. There are a few earlier poems that I still cherish, I guess. But most of them I don't. I had a whole book, my first book, when I was 27. It's about 127
Exiles
pages,
and Marriages?
Right. And I dislike almost all of it. And maybe that's not uncommon for writers to dislike their early work. But, of course, I think I'm right.
Well, since you're such a man of revision, and even from a young age, the rewriting was something you did, and you say like 250, 300 times of working with a poem to make it that, like, does that mean, but would you ever look at that Exiles and Marriages and think, well, how do I rework, would you ever rework that, or is it something of that time?
That's too...
And of yourself, then?
That's too much long ago. Mm. A couple of poems there where I've changed a title or something that are all right, but not seriously going back into it. And what I dislike about much of it is what seems to me a pursuit of metrical niceties at the expense of anything else. And that I really repeated myself again and again. Maybe I still do. But in that the poem was about its own pentameter quatrains more than about any subject.
And which is what you valued then. And you said sound is what draws you in.
Yep.
And so it makes sense that you would work within those forms of sound first, right?
They were what was around me at the time. I came out of a generation which wrote metrically. Same with Alan Tate, who was a lot older, but Richard Wilbur and early Robert Lowell were mentors, really. And that seemed to me, for about 10 years, the way to go about it.
Because you, I was reading, Donald, where you even had, I think it was Frank O'Hara who he was actually doing like working outside of that model a bit earlier, and then even when you were being the editor for the Paris Review, and when Allen Ginsberg had sent you a poem, and since it was outside of what you valued and what you felt was,
I was a damn fool.
No,
I was. I was protecting my own citadel against the barbarian invaders, you know. And after a few years, we started to meet each other and talk and become friends. And I could read them sometimes with enormous admiration. Robert Creeley, Gary Snyder, Alan to a degree, but not to such a great degree. There was a time at the beginning there when I was from sort of self-protective urges. I was very anti-beat, and I regret it, but it doesn't make much difference.
But in a way, when you think of that, you went to Harvard, and then with going to Oxford as well, and coming up with is it Phillips Exeter Academy, where you were, you can understand. This was what was surrounding you, and that was your immersion.
Yeah. I wrote papers until I was until I was 17 at Exeter. And it was during the war, and the teachers were all older, so the young men were away almost entirely. And the teachers tended to think that, Eliot, Pound were terrible, and the only good poet was Robert Frost, which made me think that Frost wasn't any good, but I know he's very good. And there was a poet called Stephen Vincent Benet, whom everyone thought was sort of Poe's successor as a great poet. And so I rebelled in talking with him and arguing with him. Some of the poems I was printing, but I began to write in regular verse. And I, regular verse, the old metrical verse. I wonder if some of me was in fact influenced by what I thought I rejected. It could be. And then, actually, Frank O'Hara did not write poems at Oxford, I mean at Harvard, as far as I knew. Later, there were some earlier ones that turned up. He was a short story writer at that time. And John Ashbery was one of the best of us, probably. And writing, not the way he does now, but with a wonderful, kind of exquisite fineness. And others of us, Adrian Rich was writing in the conventions of the time, much unlike what she became. Robert Bly was writing pentameter lyrics and pentameter narratives. Most of us changed. Jim Wright was not at Harvard, James Wright, but he was a friend of mine and somebody I admired a lot. And he wrote metrically, just brilliantly. And then it was Robert Bly in particular who argued him out of it. Jim still liked the metrical forms, but if he sent me one, he would say, "Don't tell Robert."
That's great. So it was like subversive metrical forms,
it
right?
It became subversive, right.
Well, I like the sound of that. And then, so with when you were here in Michigan, Donald, what sort of poems were you writing?
I was beginning really to write the ones I
like the kicking the leaves.
Yeah. With the short lined enjambments and lots of long vowels and so on. I began with that, and toward the end of my time here, that began to grow stale on me, and I waffled around trying to find a way to write something that would convince me. I more or less visited older things I had done and tried them again. Didn't work. And there was only one of the style I just described during that late period which worked. And then one day I began to write Kicking the Leaves, and that just opened the world up again for me. And that began on South University in Ann Arbor. But then I carried it with me to New Hampshire.
To Eagle Pond. Could we talk a little bit about that, where you made that choice?
Yeah.
You had tenure here at the University of Michigan, so that was a security unmatched for many poets. And you were married at that time to Jane Kenyon. And you both decided, because your grandmother had died, and so the family farm came to you. Is that how it goes?
The little order of things was that Jane and I both loved New Hampshire, the farm and the countryside, and I decided I had a contract which said I could take unpaid leave anytime I wanted to, and I had begun to accumulate some money, so we decided to take 1 year unpaid leave to New Hampshire. We both adored it. But by October, Jane was saying that she would chain herself in the root cellar rather than go back. And I really wanted to live there. I was just frightened of how to make a living. But I followed her. I really followed her into doing what I always wanted to do. But it was her passion and her lack of anxiety which helped me. Her family in Ann Arbor were all freelancers, musicians originally. So it wasn't such a terror for her. But I had a family. I had a father who had a family job, which was quite secure. And I grew up with that security and found it again here. And I gave it up with as I say, terror. But I also worked very hard and enjoyed it. I mean, I was writing 10 hours a day. Not all poetry. I'd work on poetry first thing in the day and then go on to work on children's books and essays and book reviews and all sorts of things for all sorts of places.
And was The Ox Cart, because that was one of your children's books that won a big award.
Right.
And then William Bolcom here at the university, he also set that to music then, too?
He set a version of it to music. He set a lot of Jane. He set much more of Jane.
He did?
He did, yeah. Oh. But he set three poems about it, all of which were New Hampshire poems, I think.
And then the poems become something new in this new form, don't they?
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
They're new again.
I just went down to the earlier this year, to the Guggenheim, where they had commissioned seven contemporary composers to do poems, to do music to go with my poems. But they were not settings. They were equivalents or attempts to get at by repetition and so on, something that was essential to the poem. And I'm very ignorant about music, and the first night I was quite bewildered, but it was two nights, and I began to get more of it. It was great fun.
Oh, it sounds it.
Yeah.
It sounds... But you decided to stay at the farm, and you got... Was the terror part of what also you believe... I mean, I guess how can we ever know? But when you said it's something changed here, when you kicking the leaves, is it something that then was able to really come into its own? Because now you're at Eagle Pond with Jane, and it was almost like you had made... To leave the academy, is it something that... was as big as it sounds.
Kicking the Leaves was written when I knew that I was spending the next year in New Hampshire. And I think that was part of it. And it talks about the country life. It begins talking about walking home from a football game in Ann Arbor. But later on, it gets to the country life. I think that some part of me knew that I was going away for good. Often, poems know things before the poet does. And actually, what happened that year, when Jane and I arrived for a year, my grandmother died at 97, and I had told my mother and my two aunts that I would like to try to buy the house after my grandmother died, not before, but after. When Jane convinced me to stay there, I had set in train the buying of the house, and I wrote to the Department of English here and resigned. And they sort of spoiled that by refusing my resignation and giving me another year's leave, you know, pay. But my mind was made up, and
Something had changed in you.
I never thought about it again. I mean, I just went ahead. I thought a lot about how I was going to make enough money to support us and pay the mortgage. And the first few years were sort of scary. When you're freelancing, you don't know today how you're going to pay for your groceries 3 months from now. But after a few years, I developed the knowledge that I don't know how, but somehow I will. So I stopped being scared.
After a few years.
Two or three.
Two or three.
I adored it in the meantime, even though I was scared.
Well, there's something about being scared also that you know you're really alive, too, because you're not just settling into something.
I think it was good for me because, I enjoyed teaching, enjoyed the classroom a whole lot. Sort of the way things were run. At the university or the department often annoyed me, but I loved walking in the classroom and teaching. But it wasn't so hard as it had been at first, and perhaps I was getting into that state that many professors do when they just sort of lock things up and throw away the key and be very fairly repetitious for the rest of their lives. I think perhaps it was in that way a good thing for me to move. I missed my students. But going around doing poetry readings, I have question periods a lot, which is a lot like talking with students, but you don't have to have papers to correct. At any rate, I think it was a good time to change jobs. You know, people change jobs in mid-career, in middle life, and it's often a very happy thing to do. I was writing poetry in Ann Arbor, writing poetry in New Hampshire, but my source of income was teaching, and then my source of income was writing all sorts of things.
Because you've written essays, children's books, yeah. The biographies. Was Henry Moore the first biography, Donald, that you wrote? Because you've written a couple of biographies.
Yes, yeah. And then later I wrote one of a baseball pitcher, Doc Ellis, who just died a year ago. But he was a wonderful man, and I love baseball, and so did Jane. So we had the opportunity to spend a good bit of time with the teens and talking to them, and that was fun to write. The book never sold, but I collected some essays about poetry and about baseball. See how confusing.
Poetry about, and baseball.
Right. About baseball, and did a book of essays, which did pretty well.
And it seems like it's always overlapped, because there's even that story of you and Robert Frost playing softball together. Is it Breadloaf, was it, Donald?
1945.
Well, let's take a short break. You've been listening to Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Donald Hall. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Today, I'm so pleased to have Donald Hall here talking with us. I should actually mention that Donald Hall is here to commemorate Day Without Art, December 1st of every year. It began in 1989, and the University Museum The University of Michigan Museum of Art commemorates this day by bringing in a special speaker person. And this year we're so lucky to have Donald Hall here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for coming, Donald. And will you read? You're going to be doing a reading later today, but we'll be actually airing this tomorrow.
Yeah.
So if you wouldn't mind reading a poem or a couple, that would be wonderful.
I'd like to read a couple, and I don't think I'll be reading tonight. So the first one was very important to me, and I wrote it early in the time I was in Ann Arbor. And it was important to me because I had the delusion that you should know what you were writing about before you wrote it. And that's a fatal delusion, because frequently the kind of hook of language will pull you into something which is mysterious to you that later you may understand, or maybe somebody else will point it out to you. One day I began this poem, the first few lines. I didn't know what I was talking about. And then I wrote a few more lines. I knew the sort of form and sound that I had, but I wouldn't begin to paraphrase. And I'd rather not today, for that matter. But I'll read The Long River. The musk ox smells in his long head, my bow coming. When I feel him there, intent, heavy, the oars make wings in the white night, and deep woods are close on either side where trees darken. I rode past towns in their black sleep to come here. I passed the northern grass and cold mountains. The musk ox moves when the boat stops in hard thickets. Now the wood is dark with old pleasures.
It's lovely. Was that the Huron?
No.
Or is it the Detroit River?
No. It was all in my head.
It was.
And, but that was one of the early ones that tended to emphasize the long amount of syllables and so on. I didn't know I was doing it. And later it got more pronounced. It was the first poem where I had sort of let myself go to language that was carrying me, and that I eventually, and other people eventually, acceded to or understood, perhaps not in the sense of paraphrase, but in the receiving of the feeling. This is another one that I wrote in Ann Arbor, but much later. And I read it now because it says I will never be able to live on the farm. And it was written only a few years before things turned around, and I was able to go there. And it's called Mount Kearsarge. And that, it wouldn't be a mountain in the west. It would be a foothill. But it stands up, and it's a beautiful thing to look at from the front of the farm. And I, as a child and going to visit there, I had always loved it. And I wrote this poem about it when I thought I could never possibly live in the house. Great blue mountain ghost, I look at you from the porch of the farmhouse where I watched you all summer as a boy. Steep slides, narrow flat patch on top. You are clear to me, like the memory of one day. Blue, blue, the top of the mountain floats in haze. I will not rock on this porch when I am old. I turn my back on you, Kearsarge. I close my eyes, and you rise inside me, blue ghost.
That's lovely. So, because that was your way of saying that it's in you, So it's okay. It's with you, even if you're not.
Not necessarily it's okay.
Well, not okay.
I do keep it inside me.
It's
always there.
Yes.
But now I'm with it inside and with it outside, which is perfect.
Yes, which is just the right balance of it. And I think there was a moment that you also were thinking about your grandmother when you when I was reading, I think in the Paris Review interview that you gave, Donald, where you said there was a moment where you realized that she had been here and looking at it as you are, and then one day someone else will also be here looking at it.
It was my great-grandfather, my grandmother's father, who picked it. And he was a sheep farmer during the Civil War, when sheep farmers probably made a lot of money. And in 1865, he moved to the River Valley farm. His sheep were pastured on a slope. It's now a ski slope where he had the pork farm. But he moved there, he said, largely because of the view of Kearsarge. It was available. There was an old cape built in 1803, and then he built in 1865 back from it. He had a big family. So it's the long stretched New Hampshire or New England farmhouse now. She grew up there and never lived anywhere else. She had three daughters, all of whom moved away. But one of them, the eldest, who was my mother, I think made pretty sure that her only child, her son, would love the place she had come from. I think she probably influenced me. And possibly one reason I loved it when I was little was to please my mother. I don't know. But I did fall in love, especially with my grandfather, who was a great storyteller, wonderful storyteller. And he also recited pieces. These were things he learned to recite at school and for entertainment of other young people. The young people of Danbury would meet every couple of weeks and play the piano, sing, have a debate, and have someone, or many people, recite pieces. And pieces were long, usually funny, maybe very sentimental poems. And the one example of the kind of piece he used that you'd be likely to recognize is Casey at the Bat. But there was...
Again, baseball.
Yeah. He loved baseball. And he followed the Boston Red Sox with a newspaper that was 2 days late. And we couldn't listen to them on the radio. They were all afternoon games. And if it was raining in New Hampshire, it tended to be raining in Fenway Park. We would hay every afternoon when it wasn't raining to miss the Red Sox. And on Sunday, you could not turn on the radio in my grandmother's house.
Oh, because of religious reasons.
Yeah. Right. So he went down once in the 90s to, it was before the Red Sox, but to see the professional baseball played. And then in the 1940s, I guess, my father drove him and me down to Fenway Park, and he saw his second baseball game of his life. Ted Williams playing right field.
Do you go to see baseball very often, Donald? Is it something that you keep up, like going to the... Have you been to Fenway?
Right now it's too difficult for my old legs, but I took a grandchild there several years in a row. And Jane and I went down. The first year we came, 1975, the Red Sox were in the World Series. And I was writing sports at that time and new sports writers. And one of them got me two seats to the first game of the World Series.
I can't beat that.
So Jen and I went down and saw the Red Sox win the first game. And, of course, they lost the seventh game.
Oh, Red Sox.
Yeah.
My brother, Eric, loves them, too, so I know the travails.
When I was living in Ann Arbor, I followed the Detroit Tigers.
Oh, yes. Yep. Yeah. Rawr.
Years when they won that World Series.
So baseball is grafted in onto you.
Yeah, it began when I was very young. Mm-hmm. People at that time took Sunday drives a lot. And in the spring and fall, my father put on the radio to the Brooklyn Dodgers. We were down in part of Connecticut that's fairly close to New York. And Red Barber told about the games. And my mother and I both kind of fell in love with baseball by listening to it on the radio.
Because then it's imagination, too, of what's happening, right, yeah, with the radio.
Yeah. Yeah. No replays.
No. Yes. Please.
No. I don't listen on the radio now. I watch on TV. But that began long before TV.
But, well, maybe we'll go back to writing a little bit.
Sure.
Donald, with your writing process now at the farm, what is it like? What's like a day in the life at the moment?
Well, I'm not writing book reviews or... I've been trying to write children's books, but since Jane's death, I've been unable to. And I can't make sense of that particularly. I finished the prose book Unpacking the Boxes a couple of years ago. And since then, I haven't been working on prose to speak of. I've had to do a couple of things. But I work on poetry every day. And what I do is revise. I seldom begin anything. But I work over ongoing poems. And I adore revising. I don't like writing first drafts because they're so terrible. But
what's so terrible about it?
Sloppy. No conclusiveness to it. Lots of bad language that I haven't noticed yet. And
But it seems like because you already know yourself, if you already know that it's going to be coming across your desk 250 or 300 times, you must know that you have to get your raw material somehow, pull it together.
Yeah.
And what sort of mysteries are you? What comes to you? Is it when you're out in the farm, and or is it when you're at your desk, or are you finding the mysteries in the revision of what you've started to build around? Or
often when I've been working on something in the morning, I will find a word flashing into my head, 8 hours later or something like that. So I think I've been thinking about it all the time, but I didn't know.
You've been mulling it.
This is the preferable word. I may have had some doubt about what I had there before. And, of course, it's not only single words, it's phrases. They're matters of syntax and matters of punctuation that occupy me when I'm at the desk or sitting in my chair working. And sometimes I'm driven to the thesaurus. Where I find the best word often, not in the synonyms, but a column or two away. Something that is close, but does something that the synonym does not do, or the original word. That's a useful tip, I think.
Yes. And you can see the joy in it, that just when you speak about it, Donald.
Really?
Like the joy, yes, you can see.
Yeah. In some ways, I think I like it best. I like it the best the more tries it takes, the more revisions I make. I really love carving away, making little changes here and there. It really pleases me. And then finally, I can't think of anything more to do with it, and I've shown it to other people, and they don't have any suggestions, or at least any that I am. Ruben. And I have to send it off to an editor. I think in many ways, these are my children, and I hate it when they go away to school. I want to keep them around.
And when you when you do send them away, though, Donald, now, like, what is the response? Like, does anyone, have you ever worked with anyone that you felt like understood your poems, like, as an editor? Because you've been an editor for other people, or is it more like you have a community? A few friends that maybe, and Jane, of course.
I have friends who tell me more. Editors often say yes or no, or they say yes, this is a wonderful performance, and that's very nice, but it's not particular. And seldom do editors reject saying what's wrong with what you sent in. One editor has recently within the past year or two. And I was able, actually, to take his comments back to the poem and improve it. And I could tell it was improved. And then I sold it to another good magazine, actually. But he had led me that way. And I wish more of them did. But I do have friends who would read and comment and give me help.
And Wednesday... you well trust now.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, you never take everything that everybody tells you.
Because you know inside, don't you? Sometimes, like, if it doesn't, you can, because you're saying the poem is a bodily thing.
Yeah, yeah. So there are, even with Jane, there are characteristic things that she would do or that I would do that the other was always going to object to. I objected to her extended verbs. You know, beginning to arrive instead of arrive. But that's an exaggerated example. And I learned repeating words from my love of Yeats. He would repeat them in a pattern often. Whenever I repeated words, Jane would cross it out and so on. So we sort of learned to ignore that part of each other. And that can be true for anybody. One time I remember sending a poem to Louise Simpson and Robert Bly on the same day. And both of them replied oddly on the same day. And each of them said that this poem was going to be good, and half of it was really good, and half of it wasn't. And they had the opposite halves. So I walked up and down being frustrated for a long time. And then I read the letters more carefully. And I learned from both letters and made a poem which was, neither of them was the poem that the other had recommended, but both, in fact, had contributed to it.
Mm.
And I think this still happens. Everything kind of lessens when you get older. Your friends die off. I mean, there are people who used to read my poems and help me out who aren't among us anymore. And also, you have to know, when you are 81 years old, as I am, that nobody yet has ever written his best work past the age of 80. Even Frost wrote 2.5 good poems after he was 80. Hardy wrote many nice poems, but not his best work. Hardy lived, they both lived to be 88, I believe. So that's all right. You just have to put up with it and do the best you can. And maybe I'll be the exception.
It's true in this life, and it's you've truly made this life of living in and with poems.
Yeah, yeah. My whole life, yeah. And even when I was 14, picking up what we were speaking about earlier, nobody was looking at my poems, nobody was recommending revision. But when I came to the end of some intolerable poem about being a mysterious figure walking the streets in the night, you know, I would go back to the beginning of it and start revising. I mean, I did that from the beginning, from when I was 14, at least. And I don't understand why I did it. But it seems a habit that was there before I knew it was a habit or knew that you ought to do it.
Yeah.
I wish more people did, more.
Cause, well, in a way, when you're saying that, Donald, I almost think, because reading some things about you, that when you returned to New Hampshire, you returned to, you started going to church because it was part of the village life in a way.
Yeah, the culture.
And so, but then there's something about the spirit, of course, that even if you're in an organized community, the space, it's still about the spirit. And I'm wondering if there isn't a way that maybe you're linked into something even at that young age. Like, you already knew this, like, this idea of revision, and you...
Yeah. Strange. I came on everything else gradually, but that was there first. And then I, you know, I found modern poetry, and I began with Poe and Keats, and then was writing in a romantic diction and so on. But then I found... with help, the great modern poets, Eliot and Stevens, and so on. Here we go.
Yes, and your voice, and your own voice.
Well, I hope so.
Yes.
Took a while.
Thank you, Donald Hall, very much for to speaking to me today. I've loved every moment.
Thank you. It's been fun.
You've been listening to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Donald Hall. Until next time. Thank you.